Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. Before I introduce my guest, I do want to invite you to stick around to the end of the episode because I have an appeal that I want to make to you, my listener, to provide some feedback on the future of this podcast. So if this is one of those episodes where you think I'm going to skip it because I haven't read the book yet, then look in the show notes and I'll probably have a time code in there for the appeal and also some information as well that you can look at. That being said, let me introduce my guest and topic. This time we are going to be discussing A Desolation Called Peace, which was the 2022 winner by Arkady Martin. And my guest is none other than Hugo Award-winning fan writer Cora Bühlert, who I've had on the podcast for a couple of different reasons over the years. But Cora, guten Abend. Danke fürs Kommen.
Sehr gut. Und vielen Dank. Und auch mir einen guten Abend.
Danke. We've just about exhausted my German at this point, though I did at least understand that. I can understand more than I can speak. That's kind of the way it works when you only take a few years of it in high school. You know, so for anybody who doesn't know you, and I don't feel like any of my listeners don't know who you are just because you've been on before, but brief, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm Cora Bühlert. I'm a translator and writer from Bremen in North Germany. And yes, I'm a blogger. I blog at my personal blog, corabühlert.com. And I'm also at Galactic Journey, where I review science fiction of 55 years past. I just actually did the 1968 Hugo winner for Galactic Journey, Lord of Light. Hmm. And got some trouble because I gave it only a lukewarm review. And gave a better review to a completely forgotten thriller from the same heist thriller, but the heist thriller was better, the better book. I'm sorry. It happens. And yes, so, and yes, I'm the Hugo winner for Best Fan Writer for 2022. So I actually, Arkady Martin and the book we are discussing today were actually won in the same year. So I don't really recall. Seeing I wasn't back yet at the computer when she won. I was probably still drinking champagne and eating chocolate and celebrating.
Yes, and you had a pretty legendary acceptance speech, complete with some Masters of the Universe figures.
Yes, with two He-Man figures, which I probably wouldn't have done, but I didn't expect to win. So I thought, okay, yeah, we were going to make this joke. Okay, I'll just do it. And I almost forgot to fetch the figures before. And I said, oh, I have to fetch the figures just in case I really need them. And yeah, I needed them.
Nice. And it's been quite a journey to get your Hugo trophy.
Yes, it is. I have the current trophy. The first trophy I got was, first it got stuck because of a security alert, a fraud alert at the shipping company, and then it was damaged and arrived broken. Parts, the backing piece was completely broken off. The thing was battered. The rocket was damaged and scratched. And so I got a replacement, and there's been quite a battle to get the shipping company to pay for the damage. And the replacement trophy was also, it was shipped in three parts, so it arrived in excellent condition, and it's assembled now. I called it my Hugo Voltron, because it's a bit of a, it's a Voltron, it's a three parts assembled, make a Hugo. But there was another issue, because, they asked, they sent repeat message, what is this? Why is this so heavy? What is this, this package? I explained a few times, and then they wanted me to pay both import duties and sales tax for something I never bought, because it's not a trade good. And I repeatedly said, this is not a trade good. I even contacted the Ministry of Finance, which is in charge of the customs offices and the Ministry of Culture. But yes, they're very happy about Germans winning Oscars and congratulate them. And half of the people who worked on that movie weren't even Germans. And managed to congratulate a Swiss guy for winning an Oscar for Germany, which is hilarious. Oh, in one case, cheering on the British cinematographer who actually beat a German cinematographer on another movie, which is also like, okay, it's nice that you celebrate every winner, but but it's still kind of silly if you don't even look up what the nationality of those people is. But yes, okay, apparently Hugo winners don't count, so there's a lot fewer Hugos in Germany than there are Oscars, actually. We have more Oscar winners than we have Hugo winners.
Sure.
Because I'm the only one, actually. Yes, it was a trick. But now I have it, and it looks really nice on the shelf downstairs.
Very nice. Very nice. So we've never really talked about, I mean, when you've been on for some of the discussion panels and that kind of stuff. And you made a delightful guest appearance on Take Me to Your Reader when we covered Das Millionenspiel. Yeah,
Das Millionenspiel.
Yes.
I'm so looking forward to covering that for the Galactic Journey when it comes out.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'll rewatch it because evidently there's a version of it that's subtitled now because I had to watch it with no subtitles. And...
Oh, that's wonderful if there's a subtitled version because you really need the subtitles. I don't know how they managed to subtitle Dieter Thomas Heck, the guy who played the host, because he's this motor mouse guy. And he's one of the best things about the movie.
Yeah. Cool. So let's talk a little bit about your history, though, as a science fiction fan. You know, where does this all come from? Movies, TV, books?
Well, it started out actually with TV and movies. So as a very small child, I saw Space, so 1999 on TV, and Star Trek, of course, reruns of the original Star Trek in the late 70s, and Time Tunnel, and I loved this very much. Then Star Wars came out, and all the kids had, I saw the toys, I saw commercials, but I couldn't see the actual movie. And also apparently couldn't make my parents understand, I want to see this movie very much, please. Please. Also for a while, I did get to see Return of the Jedi in the theater, but not the first two. Well, I was too young for that. I would have been four when Star Wars came out. Five probably when it came out in Germany, because we always had something of a lag. But yes, I liked that. And of course, then I liked on TV, there was a Japanese anime version of Captain Future, the Edmund Hamilton Golden Age hero from the 1940s, which I had no idea there were books. It was just this wonderful cartoon. And I loved it all very much. And then as I grew older, I figured out, wow, there are books just like those movies you like. That's wonderful. And yes, so I started, I think my first science fiction book was Discounting... Well, the very first one would have been Mackie in the Moon. It's an illustrated children's book, which is absolutely beautiful illustrations. It's also one of the Mackie books which still hold up because they're from the 50s and 60s, and a lot of them have very dated stereotypes. Mackie travels a lot, and yeah, when he goes to Earth, a lot of the stereotypes are very dated, and you can't really... But the Moon one still holds up. It's very good. Mm. And... Then I read some Perry Rhodan as a kid, which is a German science fiction series in which is published in magazines, little digest-sized magazines that you can buy at the newsstand. And I read some of those, or usually I just read the collections from the library. And my first real science fiction book was Keeper of the Aesis Light by Monica Hughes, who's a Canadian writer of YA science fiction. And then I found a Star Wars novelization and bought that. And yeah, then I found the imports, the spinner rack with science fiction novels at the import bookstore. There was a bookstore which had imported foreign language paperbacks or books. Well, all sorts of those. I think half of what they had were dictionaries and so on. And books for students and university students. They could order almost everything for you. But that this spinner rack with science fiction and sometimes also mystery and romance paperbacks, and yes, they were really expensive at the time, but I bought a lot of them, and that's how I found Isaac Asimov and Anne McCaffrey and Arthur C. Clarke and Heinlein and lots of books, including that's also around the time I figured out that winner of the Hugo Award usually meant this is a good book.
Right. You know, one of the questions that I often ask is why this book, but I pretty much asked you to cover this one. So we don't really need to cover that just because I'm getting down to it. And, you know,
yeah, you offered me three books and I said I'd be happy with every one of them, even the one no one else likes.
And thank you so much.
But I'm quite happy to have gotten this one because it's actually, it wasn't my first choice actually, but because last year was a very, very strong year for novels, but it's a winner I'm perfectly happy with.
Nice. Personal history with this title. Did you read it in 2021?
I did, actually. I read A Memory Called Empire when it came out and enjoyed it and got the sequel when it came out. Well, when it came out in paperback, actually. Okay. Because I normally don't buy hardcovers because they're too pricey. But I read it, and so I had already read it when it was Hugo nominated, and... I obviously enjoyed the first one enough to buy the sequel, and there's a lot to like about this book.
Yeah, for some reason, well, by the time I did an episode on A Memory Called Empire, I thought that A Desolation Called Peace would have been nominated in the following year, because I wasn't clear on what the timeline of publishing was. And so I remember saying in that episode, the sequel didn't win, so I guess I'll never have to cover that one. Turns out I was incorrect.
Yeah, there was a lag. There was a 1 year lag between the two books.
Yeah. So why don't we start our kind of non-spoiler discussion of the book? Do you want to try to give a synopsis for this one? Of course, there's spoilers for the previous book inherent in this one.
Well, we're still basically the situation is there's I'm probably terribly butchering the name, and I'm very sorry to Academy Teen, really sorry for butchering the names of, but takes Kalan Empire, which is a very powerful space empire, which is partly based on the Byzantine Empire, and also partly based on Mesoamerican empires. And there's Liesel Station. I keep pronouncing it Liesel Station because it looks like...
I think
like
Liesel sounds better. It sounds like it's from the Sound of Music.
it looks like the name Liesel. Liesel, which is a German, old-fashioned German name. Well, it's right. Liesel Station, which is a space station with about 30,000 inhabitants, which is close to the Taixkalan Empire, but also independent and would very much like to remain independent. And... our protagonist is Mahit Dismar. She's Liesel's new ambassador. Well, in the first book, she's a new ambassador to the Taixkalan Empire. She's very much, she loves her culture very much, but the Taixkalan thinks she's a barbarian. And she has something called an imago in her head, which is broken and which has the personality of the former emperor, former ambassador who was murdered. And then there's also three seagrass. Sorry, I keep missing up those names. They all have the Taixkalan naming conventions are number and usually some kind of biological object.
Yeah, noun.
Object, right. And it's number and noun, and it's really easy to get them mixed up. So I'm also very sorry if I get them all mixed up now. But her assistant is three seagrass, and who's Taixkalani, and... there is a romance blossom between them, and the first book is basically a murder mystery, because it's a murder mystery to figure out who murdered the previous ambassador, the Iskander. And now in this one, Mahit is back home on Liesel Station, but the people of Liesel are not exactly happy with her because I think she's way too taste to Taixkalani, and can we even trust her? And also something else has happened because aliens have appeared. Aliens who are not humanoid. Not a human. The Taixkalani and the Liesel people are human. They're not human. They're outside the jump gates. They keep attacking ships and killing people, and no one knows why I can communicate with them. Them and the Taixkalani have no idea what's happening. So Sri Seagrass shows up at Liesel Station to visit Mahit and tries to drag her into helping out. Figuring out how to communicate with these aliens, because Mahit is also... a linguist and very, very good at it. And there's also a plot involving the Taixkalani fleet and their commander, Nine Hibiscus, and there's a Taixkalani cloned emperor, Eight Antidote, who's still a child, so I think he's 11 or 13 or something, and is trying to figure out what he wants to do. And but the main plot is also, well, it's Mahit and Three Seagrass and Nine Hibiscus trying to figure out what the aliens want and communicate with them. Nine Seagrass doesn't want to start a war. The Taixkalani want one. And Liesel also wants a war, because if the Taixkalani are busy with the aliens, they'll leave Liesel Station alone. And basically, yes, this is the first one was a murder mystery. This is a first contact novel. And it focuses quite a lot on, well, linguistics and attempting to communicate. And as someone who is, I call myself an accidental linguist, because I studied English and linguistics is part of the courses you have to take linguistics classes. And I actually also taught linguistics at the University of Fechter, which no one has ever heard of. It's actually the smallest. Yes, it's a rural university. It's that grew out of a Catholic teacher training college and an agrarian school. And it's Germany's smallest university. So no one has ever heard of it. Actually, they bought Ancillary Justice for their library on my recommendation, which is fun. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a pretty good description of it. It kind of breaks down into sort of A/B/C plots where two of them eventually merge, but one of them kind of stays. It sort of feeds into it.
Yeah, so the Empire plot is a bit separate.
So let's start with overall thoughts. It sounds like you were a big fan of this one.
Well, I liked it a lot. I liked it. Like I said, it wasn't actually, but last year was very, very strong. I think it was my number three. See, my top one was actually Light from Uncommon Stars by Rika Aoki, which was my top. Mm. And I had, I think also I had a Master of Jin ahead of this one. I'd have to look up my notes, because I kept shuffling them around because it was such a strong year. Only the bottom two always stayed the same, but the top four I kept shuffling around because I liked them all very much.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to eventually being able to read more of the new releases as they come
yes,
out.
Yes, of course, you were stuck with a lot of past Hugo winners, and I guess, yeah. And knowing what some of the past winners are, a lot of them probably weren't really what you wanted to read.
Right. Well, it's not even necessarily that, right? It's just that I don't really have the option to read what I want to read. Because
yeah, of course. You have to read what someone decided was Yoga-worthy 20, right. 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not complaining. I set myself this project.
Yeah,
and
it's a great project. I mean, it's also great that we also have Yoga Girl doing something similar.
Yes, yeah.
And also suffering from some of the same issues.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed A Memory Called Empire. I liked the murder mystery aspect of it. That's what kind of worked for me. And so any of the other things in the book that might annoy me a little bit didn't really. And where with this one, with the three plots where two of them were sort of more important than the third, I think if I pulled them all each out individually, I liked all three plots. But I didn't necessarily think they needed to be in the same book. And so the book just felt a little overstuffed to me. And it was a little kind of a frustrating read. It was tough for me to get through. Not to say I didn't necessarily enjoy it. It just didn't totally work for me. But, you know.
Well, I have to say I'm a bit surprised it won because sequels so very rarely win Hugos. Mm. And in a lot of cases where a sequel won, in about half the case, I also think, well, it would have been okay if the first one won, but the second one didn't. Like I said, I liked this one, but I was still surprised that it won because I expected one of the other ones to win. Of course, we had another sequel there, but that was more of a loose sequel.
Yeah, and you know, like you look at the Broken Earth series, and it's essentially one long novel, broken into three books. And so that makes sense. It's doing the same thing, but doing it really well. Where here, and I'll give credit where it's due, this is not the same thing as A Memory Called Empire. It's in the same universe, but it's a very different, more space opera first contact story, rather than the murder mystery that the first one was.
The Broken Earth is basically a Lord of the Rings situation with where you have three books which are one long story. Or, if the version I had of Cytene was also, which is of course a Hugo winner, and one that a lot of people mm-hmm. struggle with. I struggled with it myself, but it's the version of Cytene mm-hmm. I have is actually a paperback copy split in three books. And for the longest time, I had no idea that it was originally one book. Book I kept asking like, what do you mean? One third of the first book is a slog, and then it gets better, and then turns out no, the entire first book in my version is a slog.
I think also the fact that it had been 2 years or so since I've read A Memory Called Empire, this book does not stand alone terribly well. Hmm. It relies on a lot of the stuff that happened in the previous book, and I had forgotten a little bit of it. I read the Wikipedia summary, of it.
Yeah, also, I have to admit, I still had to look it up when I knew I was going to get this one for the podcast. I had to look up both the first one and this one again, because it had been a while since I read it.
Yeah, and one of the, I think, I can't remember if we were recording when you started talking about the names.
The names are really, okay, naming conventions are always, if you're not from the culture, naming conventions are weird to a lot of people. Yes. But these names are really difficult to get a handle on because simply they're so similar. It's like, I keep saying, is it nine? It's nine hibiscus and three seagrass and 20 cicada, or is it the other way around?
Right. Yeah. And even when you look in there's a glossary in the back of the book that lists, places and names. And so, there's five or six characters that are all named six something, right? Yeah. And it just doesn't read like a name to me. And so it makes it harder for me, harder to be memorable as to who that person is. And so that was a real struggle for me.
I mean, people with similar names is an issue everywhere. I mean, my graduating class, we had four girls called Britta and four called Claudia, and I don't know how many boys called Niels we had. There were still all different Christians and so on. All different people. So it's normally not an issue in fiction, but that's simply because we are very careful not to have similar names in fiction. Writers are always told, don't have similar. And even if sometimes the names aren't even similar to. I think it was Doctor Who that they had on Torchwood, that character called Gwyneth and one called Gwen, which is not at all similar if you're Welsh, as a writer was, but which is similar to everybody who's not Welsh.
Right. Yeah, that's often a problem in a book. When you have two characters that have names that start with the same letter, it's very easy to smash them together.
This is just the way people respond to. We have an idea of what a name is and how it works, and works in our culture. And when faced with a different, or in this case, a largely made-up version of names, it's difficult.
And, you know, I did like that there's sort of a saving grace in there for a few of the characters that help you remember them, like Three Seagrass is called Reed, right? It's kind of a nickname, a pet name that goes with Seagrass, or you have Swarm for 20 Cicada. So that helps a little bit, but I don't know. It bothered me, and I felt like this is irrational to not like this naming convention as much as I don't like it. And it didn't really bother me in the first book, like I said. You know, Mahit and Yuskander, those are names that I can...
Yeah, those you can easily remember. And the Lizal people also have more... But the Taxkalani people, they all have these names. And there's also a lot more Taxkalani people with big roles in this one than there were in the first one. In the first one, you basically had three Seagrass, and the others were supporting characters.
Yeah, and 19 ads, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's not totally a spoiler because we talked about the war and where the audiobook says LaSalle Station. So
LaSalle, okay.
There's not enough vowels in there for LaSalle, it to really be that. But
it's just actually there is no I in there. For some reason I just read it at Liesel, as Liesel original, and that's how it stuck in my name. But if it's LaSalle, then
yeah. But their idea that, hey, let's get the Empire into this war with the spit goo aliens, and that'll keep us out of it. And I think that's really, really naive. You're still close enough.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, the real world is just proving everybody wrong on that one.
Mm-hmm.
On that one, because a lot of countries are being drawn into the Russia-Ukraine war, even though they don't want to be. Germany is being pushed into delivering weapons, which is against, actually, we have the policy we don't deliver weapons into, especially offensive weapons, into hot war zones. Even if we like one of the parties or agree with them, we don't. There are some exceptions made for NATO partners and for Israel, but even those are controversial. There was a lot of complaints about delivering tanks to Turkey, because they might use them to fight the Kurds, probably did. But there's a lot of, most people here say, this isn't really our war. It's sad, but it's not our problem. But our government can't or won't keep out of it, because NATO is pushing. So yeah, it's naive if Liesel thinks they can stay out of it, especially since we're dealing with aliens here who can't really tell, who don't really understand what humans are, or if they even are sentient, and who definitely can't tell a human from Liesel from a Taxkalani, because they all look the same to them.
Exactly, yeah. I think we should probably skip over into spoilers as soon as possible, just to, you know, just so we can talk about whatever we want to. But did you have any, I always try and come up with comps for this book. Did you have anything that you would recommend based on that?
Recommendations are difficult. I mean, the linguistic aspects, if you like those, then there's of course, which did not win a Hugo, unfortunately. There's Babel 17 by Samuel Delaney, which also is about trying to decipher a language, and which is an alien language, which is actually dangerous because it changes people's minds and turns them into unwitting traitors. It's not really, it's quite different from this one, but it's a very, very good book, and I think everybody should read it. And it sadly did not win the Hugo, lost out to the moon is a harsh mistress.
It did win the nebula, though.
Yeah, it did win the nebula, which I was very happy about, even though it happened before I was born. And there's also, of course, the story, it's called The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang, and the movie Arrival, which is also about attempting to communicate with aliens and what it does to the people, even though there is no war in that one.
Right. Yeah, those are excellent. Those are ones that I had written down as well. There's some common DNA here with the ancillary series, just because of the, you know, Galactic Empire kind of idea.
Yeah, it's modern space opera. They're both the Imperial Rat series and Memory Called Peace and the Desolation Called... No, sorry. A Memory Called Empire and the Desolation Called Peace and others. They're all part of this modern space opera trend of somewhat offbeat science fantasy based. Also, the Hexachat series by Yun Ha Lee is another similar one, all three books were nominated, but none of them won as a Hugo because they had the misfortune of being up against the Broken Earth trilogy. Nine Fox Gambit and I forgot what the other ones were called.
Right.
That one was also, they're not the same, but they're obviously all part of the same current trend, which is quite the space opera we have. We have a space opera revival, but it's very different from the space opera revival we had in the late 90s, early 2000s, when we had this new British space opera, which was very male-dominated, made it very technologically, lots of AI and singularity stuff, so the sort of Charles Stross, Ian Banks, and early Alistair Reynolds, and so on. So, and this is very different. This kind of space opera is very different. And actually, a kind of space opera I prefer to the previous iteration. The one which really brought this new type of space opera into the genre mainstream was Ancillary Justice, which was the breakout.
Yeah.
The Expanse is also sometimes, but The Expanse, I think, is closer to the previous. It's not new British space opera, obviously, but it's closer to the previous style than this one is.
It just occurred to me, I mean, like you were talking about the male-dominated space opera before, and now you have a book like this where basically all of the authority figures are female.
Yeah.
And it hadn't even occurred to me until just now that you have, you know, you have close advisors that are male, like 20 Cicada with Nine Hibiscus, I think. But Nine Hibiscus is
all of the important characters in this one, except for Eight Antidote. Everybody, and Eight Antidote is an 11-year-old boy, old kid. Everybody else is female. And also, of course, the Imperial Rat series takes it one further because a lot of the time everybody is referred to the female pronoun, the generic female pronoun, but we don't even know what the gender these people are because it also doesn't really matter to them.
Right, yeah, and that's kind of what I was going to say, was it didn't even stick out to me that was the case until it just occurred to me, because it doesn't matter in this universe. So let's go ahead and jump over into spoilers so we can talk about whatever we want to from here on, okay? The plot, the kind of A/B/C plot, the C plot I'm referring to is the Eight Antidote, heir to the throne kind of plot. Yeah. I didn't really see what we were... It does connect, but I didn't really...
I kind of liked it, but it was a case of like, okay, why are these chapters... For a long time, I was honestly wondering, what are these Eight Antidote chapters even doing here? Why is it here? It's like, okay, I like the character, and I like his struggles to figure out what kind of emperor do I want to be, and how do I want to rule, but... It felt as if a completely different book or novella had wandered in.
That's exactly my take on it as well.
It's like a case of like, okay, this might have worked better as a separate novella. The Nine Seagrass and Mahit plots, of course, do intersect because they both deal with the same issue.
I wonder. I mean, it's. I don't know if you've heard the theory that Indiana Jones doesn't affect the plot of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It doesn't at all. Indiana Jones never really affects any plot. Indiana Jones, things happen to him. In the Indiana Jones movies, they violate every modern storytelling principle. Things happen to Indy, he reacts, mostly he barely survives, and then in the end, he is saved by divine intervention. Judeo-Christian in 1 and 3, Hindu in 2, and in 4 is aliens. And who knows who will save his bacon in 5. but likely right. not Indy himself, because he never saves himself. He doesn't.
Yeah, but, yeah. But that kind of, it occurred to me that does eight antidote do anything? And even at the end, he asks that question, right? He asks 19 ads, did the letter that I sent, did it change anything? And she kind of goes, maybe. Because well, by that time, what is it, 16 Moonrise? That's the squadron commander? I can't remember. 16 yeah, something.
I think, yeah, 16. So I don't. I haven't. I'm looking up, but I haven't noted down their name.
But by that time, she's committed to essentially wiping out the alien homeworld. Mm. And that's where the title comes in, right? A desolation called peace, right? If you
from Tacitus, the Roman historian. It's actually wrote it down. I wrote down the English translation because I could read out the Latin one, but no one would understand. To ravage, to slaughter, to usurp under false titles, they call empire. And where they make a desert, they call it peace. Yes.
Right. Right, and that's what she's attempting to do, is to peace through superior firepower kind of idea.
It's not just what she's trying to do. It's a thing which sadly happens throughout human history.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, we saw it in the Iraq war. We're seeing it in Ukraine right now. It's, let's make peace by shooting everything, by bombing or shooting everything else to smithereens.
Yeah. But so for me, the plot that really, really worked was I enjoy Mahit and Three Seagrass. They're a fun couple. There's kind of the will they want they kind of thing.
Yeah, the romantic interplay and the will they won't say dynamics between those two are great. Right. Yeah. And also I simply like Mahit as a character, and also I like her conflict between being and liking the Texcalani culture, even though they think she's a barbarian, and also, getting crap from her own people for liking the Texcalani a little too much, because this is something that happens a lot. Happened to me when I was a kid, that I was, if you enjoyed American movies too much and so on, they were all violent American trash, and it's very bad, or American toy. Oh, those terrible American plastic toys. Of course, Lego is also made from plastic, but no one apparently seemed to care about that. It wasn't the plastic that were, or Playmobil. It's not the plastic that's evil, it's the Americans that were. Because when I was a kid, the 1968 style anti-Americanism, the anti-Vietnam War movement, which morphed in certain people on the left into anti-Americanism, was still in full. Of course, we're seeing about the opposite right now, because suddenly people are being, opera houses are being attacked for playing Tchaikovsky because, the Russians are our enemy now. And, Tchaikovsky obviously isn't your enemy. Or people get told off on the subway for reading a book by a Russian author who actually is dead and the Strugatsky brothers. They're dead and they're dead and B, I'm pretty sure they would not approve of Vladimir Putin and the war in Ukraine. So. Right. We're seeing this obvious. So yes, if you like a culture that's not yours, and doesn't have to be a hegemonic culture. Try eating ramen noodles. I worked in the school. I had a cup noodles, ramen noodles and chopsticks. And in the break, I just made water, boiled water, poured it into my pot, and started eating my cup noodles with chopsticks, and this was apparently something that was really disliked because those noodles are very bad for your health. And basically the thing was, this is foreign and we don't like you doing this foreign thing. And and those were very, very enlightened leftist teachers. So it wasn't like the actionaries. It was just like, this woman is doing this weird foreign thing we don't want the children to do. Also, even using English words can be a problem in Germany sometimes. If you use an English word and there's, we really have a movement about keep our language free from those terrible foreign words. It's an old movement, used to be against French words. Now suddenly they all hate English words. And if another language becomes hegemonic, then they will hate that one. But I could really sympathize with that aspect of the book.
Yeah, she's kind of polluted by the empire so that the people on LaSalle don't trust her. But also she's a barbarian. And she really bristles at being called a barbarian because she feels like, look, I write the poetry, I enjoy the literature. But, she's also obviously a barbarian because the stationers are a little larger than
She looks different. That's another thing. Yeah. I mean, this is not really, but this is actually what the Roman Empire, they called everybody else a barbarian. Mm-hmm. Even if those people, and a lot of those barbarians had high-ranking positions in the Roman Empire. They were military officers, but they were still always, oh, the terrible barbarians. Mm-hmm. And again, you could usually see that those people looked different.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and there's often, the us versus them idea where you assume that the other is the backwards people. And like in the English language, if you call somebody a Philistine, you're saying that they're uneducated, right? Yeah, but if you really look at the history of that region, the Philistines were more technologically advanced than the Israelites and the Palestinians at the time. I mean, and that's where the word Palestine comes from as well. But since they were the enemy of the God's people, that's the connotation.
You see this now. We get a lot of we have a lot of refugees here from Syria, Iraq, and the Middle East, and you always get this, oh, those terribly ignorant goat herders, and they're all knife killers and so on. A lot, and the people we get here, the refugees, they're not the goat herders. The goat herders are way too poor. We get the middle classes. We got the people are the educated middle classes. We got very well educated people. We got teachers and doctors and so on. But the usual racist can't really tell that those are very highly educated people because they don't interact with them. They just see, okay, these people look different, and I have a preconception in my head about what those countries are about, alike, which is basically based on some Lords of Arabia or even further back kind of fantasies. So I have my preconception, even though it's complete nonsense.
Yeah. So as I understand it, there isn't actually a third book planned in this series. Everything I've seen from Martin says that.
I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, I saw something somewhere that said it was planned as a duology. It's one emotional arc, essentially. And she said that she might be writing some novellas or some shorter stuff that features, in the same universe. But so I wasn't completely able to tease out all the information about Amnarbat, who's the person who it was like the counselor for heritage, I think, on LaSalle Station, who was trying to insist that Mahit come in and have a brain dump taken, right? Create a new imago line. Mm-hmm. And Mahit is reluctant to do this because she's sort of three people, because she's Mahit plus the broken, sabotaged Iskander imago, and then the newer one as well. And so she basically knows, look, if I go under that procedure, they're probably just going to kill me.
Also, they don't like Mahit anyway. So they don't trust her, and she has a broken imago she's not talking about. So, yes. I did feel the ending was a bit open for something, for what is supposed to be a definitive ending.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, because you don't have Mahit landing in her final destination.
We don't know what happened to Mahit. We know we know that the war was averted, but we don't know what happened to Mahit. So it's a bit open. There's definitely room for more if she ever wants to write more.
Yeah, the first contact part of this is the part that really worked for me. I really enjoy that, the mystery of it, when they're like, okay, these other aliens are clearly communicating with each other without any kind of language. And then their language and their attempts to communicate with the Texcalanli fleet, it comes across as almost a weapon, right? Because of the sounds that they emit build on each other and cause violent nausea reactions. And that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. There was a Star Trek Discovery episode, which also had a similar issue with these aliens who, accidentally wipe out entire planets, but apparently have no idea what they're doing, and they can't communicate with them, and because the aliens communicate via some kind of pheromones, and this was my favorite episode of Discovery, probably of all time, because it was just trying to figure out what are these people even trying to say, and can they even communicate?
Yeah, that's always interesting to me, and like you said, the comparison with Arrival and the Story of Your Life is excellent, and it was a. I think it was necessary for the plot of the book for the negotiations to take place on this very inhospitable planet so that they couldn't just stay there for days.
It adds a ticking clock element. So they can't just say, oh, like we will, because normally such negotiations and also even deciphering the language would take months, if not years. It's all very compressed. Yeah.
And the, you know, that environment then inflicted extra harm on them because they're attempting to more or less sing to communicate. And they've got this sort of, I think they figured they had maybe established a pidgin that could be used to communicate, but not a language.
Well, I mean, the language is so incompatible that they literally have no idea how to communicate with them. A pidgin or another shortcut is all they can get.
I mean, and that's one of the first, kind of the first things that happens when cultures meet anyway, is that is established. And then it gradually, you can add a grammar onto it, and then you have a Creole before you get into an actual separate language.
Yeah, that's simply, that's the way things work. People, mm-hmm. pidgins are the first thing that develops. Even when even when someone comes to a new country, a group of immigrants, most of what they speak is some kind of pidgin version of the dominant language, and among themselves they speak their own language until mostly one or two generations in.
Yeah. So, did you have any favorite parts you wanted to talk about from the book? Any events or themes?
I think I already talked about a lot of my favorite. Like I said, I liked the whole linguistic and cultural aspects, and also Mahit's conflict about, and of course I always like it if the solution to contact with a very, very different and almost unknowable and not understandable alien species is not shoot them dead. Because in our genre, because it's way too often the solution is, oh, those things are very alien and they're kind of hostile, so shoot them dead. I mean, don't know if you've read Arena, the short story which inspired the Star Trek episode.
Yep.
And the Star Trek episode actually comes to a better ending. It's like we try to communicate, but in Arena it's basically, I think there's one attempt to communicate and then it's just, oh, those things are so alien and so very different, let's just kill them. Kill them, genocide is good, which I really didn't like about the story.
Well, in that, there's the moderator that's essentially, here we're going to have a single combat, whichever side wins.
Yeah, a single combat, but the human combatant tries to, I think, once communicate with the alien, but then decides the alien is way too alien to understand. Also, it's not a gun, it's a red ball. It's a red bouncing ball of hatred, a rubber ball of hatred, I think I called it in my review. But of course, that was a story from World War II, and nowadays it's not so, but... the kind of store Amazon is still full of generic military science fiction where, hey, let's, those aliens are those insectoid or reptilian aliens, let's shoot them all dead. I'm always very happy when it doesn't go that way.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of the backdrop to the beginning of Ender's Game, right, where you had that disastrous meeting between these species where there couldn't be communication.
Ender's Game is basically, well, what happens if I forgot, the 16 something or other had gotten their way.
Yes, yeah, precisely.
16 something or other, it's a weird name for this person, but...
I'm going to say it's 16 Moonrise. Actually, let me just check in the back of the... I've got it, I can look it up. 16 Moonrise it is, okay.
16 Moonrise, okay.
Yeah, and, you know, I also like that Nine Hibiscus, that's the commander of the fleet.
Yeah,
I think Hibiscus. You know, she has to make a very dire decision, right? Mm-hmm. She knows that if 16 Moonrise succeeds and wipes out this planet, then there's no hope for peace. And so she makes the difficult decision to say, I can tell you how to stop her. One condition, you have to try to just disable the ship. You know, mm-hmm. just take her out and we'll be good. No, don't sacrifice that entire other fleet.
There's also, isn't there, there's a, what's it called, Failsafe or something, a movie from the, came out the same year as Dr. Strangelove, but it plays it, I think, even based on the same book, but it plays it straight, whereas it's also...
It's not.
No, it's not, but it came, it's very, it's both similar themes about, someone going rogue and being, of, in one case, it's an accident that this plane is launched, also it's a guy going rogue and almost starting World War III. And in one case, it sort of succeeds. Well, in both cases, he sort of succeeds. Yeah. In one case, I think it's New York or something. That's new. The CIA, I never liked the previous one. I like Dr. Strangelove, but the other one, Failsafe, I never liked that one.
I like both. And you're very duly lobbing up references to episodes that we've done on Take Me to Your Reader, because
of course you would have, because it's based on a book. You would have probably done it.
Yes. Yeah. And we did. Sort of a two-part series on Red Alert and Failsafe. Those are the two books. There was a lawsuit because they're so similar.
Oh, yes, exactly, because then, it's different books, right?
yeah. And then the movies are quite different, just because Dr. Strangelove is Kubrick, and that's very different.
It was the nuclear war anxiety, and especially during that, it sort of receded in the 1990s, but now it's making a comeback. But we got very close to a simple mistake, a wrong sensor reading or something, a broken sensor, almost starting World War III. And we all know where that would have ended. I mean, we've seen The Day After, Threats, or The War Game, or all of those movies.
Yeah. Based on what you were talking about Star Wars, I think we're about the same age. And so there was a point where, when I was in high school, that's when the Berlin Wall came down. Mm-hmm. And
it came down on my grandma's 70th birthday. Exactly. Oh, wow. Yes, wow. And she was East German. She was born near Dresden. She came from a smaller town near Dresden, and it was this was the best birthday present ever for my grandma. She got 70, she turned 70, and the wall came down. And she actually, her niece and nephew, who were, because East Germans were not allowed to travel to the West, only in very special circumstances, if you were over 60 or 65, you could travel because, the pensioners, they just cost money. No one cares if they stay because they just cost money. But the people who could, pensioners could travel, but the people who were younger couldn't travel, and they got a special permission, her niece and nephew, because they were still of working age. They must have been their 40s or 50s. And they visited. Were here, and then they opened the wall, and my first thought was, that's so mean. Now Uncle Klaus and Aunt Margaret can visit us and go to the West, and they can't even go back and tell everybody, hey, the West is so cool because everybody can go now.
Right. Yeah, but I think people of our generation, and maybe it's naive, but I felt like we were out of the woods, the Cold War's over, and we don't have to worry about nukes anymore or terrible wars.
Me too. I also thought, that nonsense is over now. Mm-hmm. We had contact to people on the other side of the Iron Curtain. A lot of people it wasn't so common in the US, but a lot of people in Europe had contact, especially in Germany, because you had relatives on the other side. And people had also had contact to, I actually visited the Soviet Union just before the wall fell on one of the first student exchanges. Well, it's now actually, it's Latvia now. It's not it wasn't Russia, it's Latvia now. Now, so it's an independent state, but it was the Soviet Union back then. Yeah. And so we had contact, and I also thought, so we knew those people, and they're kind of like us. Okay, maybe they listen to, they kind of don't know what the cool music is. They still think this music that we no longer listen to is cool, but they're a bit weird about some other things, but they're kind of like us, of course, so we don't need to worry about any of those nukes anymore.
Right.
Yeah, that was sadly wrong.
In the last episode that I did with David Brin, where we did not talk about the book very much, we talked more about his
work.
Beyond This Horizon, Heinlein. Oh. We mentioned it a few times, but mostly I just chatted with him. But we talked a little bit about one of his books, where he talked about the self-preventing prophecy, the use of science fiction to help us prevent future scenarios by talking about them, by writing about them, and helping us dwell on those things. And I think that science fiction still is very important for that reason, especially because it turns out we weren't out of the woods.
I think that science fiction, not so much the books, but definitely the movies, The Day After, Threats, and so on, did help to prevent nuclear war, because they showed everybody, okay, this is what happens. We can't win this. Everybody will die miserably.
Yeah, it reminds me of the ending of Alas, Babylon, which is a book about a nuclear exchange. And at the end of that, someone says, oh yeah, we beat them, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, most of the time you don't even know whether anybody beat anybody because it doesn't really matter anymore. It's also, yeah. I wonder if we will see a resurgence of the nuclear war science fiction, because that quite abruptly vanished in around 1989, 1990. A few books still came out, but it abruptly vanished when it stopped being a scenario to be afraid of.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that on a recent episode that I did with Dan Smith. We were talking about apocalyptic fiction and how it kind of dipped. After the Cold War.
We still have apocalyptic fiction, but now it's climate change apocalypses and sometimes zombies and pandemic apocalypses. I think the pandemic ones will probably recede for a while as well, because it's like been there, done that.
Yes.
On the other hand, The Last of Us was really successful. But yeah, science fiction might also have helped because of with the climate change issue to even tell people or simply also environmental issues in general. I mean, we had things like where late the sweet birds sang Stand on Zanzibar and so on, which also threatens. Also, the overpopulation scenario of the 1960s is another one which sort of self-prevented itself. Not so much because people were terrified, but simply because more education and more better birth control and also better farming methods made sure that we had more food for people and people had fewer kids.
Right. You also mentioned earlier Arena, which is another thing that we did cover it on Take Me to Your Reader, just because we wanted to talk about Star Trek. And there's more than one Star Trek episode that's similar.
Very few Star Trek episodes which are fairly close adaptation, which are also credited as an adaptation of something else.
Yeah. Just looking back at my notes to see if there's anything else that I wanted to talk about. I did really enjoy 20 Cicada as a character, Swarm. Because he's given that name because he just seems to know everything. He seems to be everywhere at once. And then, of course, through the book, you find out that the aliens have some kind of a fungus that allows them to communicate as almost a hive mind. And he takes that on and becomes kind of the Locutus of Borg for that race.
Yeah. Also,
and he really becomes a swarm.
Fungi are really fashionable right now in science. They're a new trend. I mean, we have the fungus network in Star Trek Discovery. We have the fungus zombies in The Last of Us. So fungi are, and of course, Jeff Vandermeer did fungi before anybody else did. We need to have a way to make people zombies and fungi work quite well with insects, so yeah, so a bit of extrapolation, and it works with humans.
Yeah. Anything else that you've got in your notes that you want to cover?
Not really, really, except, it's basically, yes, it's based on the Byzantine Empire, but it's basically, the Taxkalani Empire is every empire which both military dominant and also dominant via soft power, whether it's the British Empire or the U.S. in the post-World War II era, or the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain. You can apply it to almost any empire, even if the Byzantine Empire was the actual inspiration.
When you say soft power, are you talking about like culture?
Yeah, culture, kind of movies,
language,
poetry in this case is a big one. Hard power is, of course, military and political power. We bully you via our military And soft power is, we export our culture to you and our movies, our music, our fashions, our poetry, our literature, our language.
Right. And then that's why you get in trouble for watching American movies and reading American books.
Yeah, and then it's violent American trash. Very, very bad. Violent American trash. Interestingly, the worst, it's silly. There were three things that really hated: Rambo, Rocky, and Conan. And if you want violent American trash in the 80s, there are plenty of violent action movies. Of course, I love them all, but honestly, those are about the worst. The Rocky movies, the early one, the first one, was an Oscar winner. It was an immigrant story about a young immigrant boxer. It wasn't violent trash. It's a boxing movie. Rambo started out as a story about a disaffected Vietnam vet. It's also not... Yes, it's violent, but it's not violent trash.
It's anti-war, though.
The first one's not at all. And Conan is a literary adaptation of it's not really Robert E. Howard. It's mixed from several Robert E. Howard stories. But it's a literary adaptation of sword and sorcery stories from the 1930s. So none of them really are the violent trash. And also, it's not that different from the sword and sandal movies from Italy. None of them really are the violent American trash if they wanted that, they would have said something like Missing in Action or American Ninja, whatever those movies were called. There, yes. There were a lot of them which really were kind of violent trash and still a lot of fun. But
oh, yeah, I love violent American trash.
Yeah. I mean, it was really Masters of the Universe toys or Star Wars toys, very violent American trash. It might inspire kids to do violence, which is like, how? I don't have a lightsaber. I don't have a laser gun. I don't have a power sword that turns me into He-Man. He-Man, what on earth should this inspire? It actually inspired a lot of good things, but yeah, it was just educators being weird. Even the old Looney Tunes cartoons were very bad. Porky, they actually banned Porky Pig in Germany. Porky Pig.
Wow.
He was very, very violent trash. I think we might all get inspired to buy Acme products and blow up Roadrunners or something like that.
Nice. Final thoughts on this book?
Well, I like it. I was surprised that it won because sequels so rarely win. And there's only, I actually wrote down all the sequels which won. We had Speaker for the Dead, sequel to Ender's Game, which both won. We had Blue Mass and Green Mass both winning, but the first one didn't, in the trilogy didn't win. We had Forever Peace, the sequel to Forever War, which is one which baffles me why it won, probably because Haldeman was a beloved author, because I'm not really sure why that one won.
And it's not even really a sequel.
Yeah, it's not really, but it's... I've never understood why that one won. Okay. Okay. I understand why the Forever War won, but not why Forever Peace won. And then we have the Lois McMaster Bujolts, The War Game, Baraya, and Mirror Dance. All of whom are, well, the first ones in the series didn't win, but later ones in the series did. And of course, the N.K. Jameson triple for The Broken Earth.
Right. I mean, you do have two wins for Werner Vinge in connected books.
Oh, yes, yes. Really... I forgot them because I'm not a Werner Vinge fan at all, so I mostly ignore them.
Well, the second one is a prequel as well.
Yeah, so. I don't have your project, so I don't have to read them, and so I sort of forgot about them. But yes, you're right.
I enjoyed both of those. So, yeah. You know, as usually happens, I feel like I came into this thinking this is a book 6.5 out of 10, and now I'm like, no, it's more like a 7.5. So I appreciate the conversation.
It's definitely one of the better Hugo winners, but like I said, it was a very, very strong year last year, and it wasn't. Actually, all the years I've been voting, only one year my first choice actually won in novel, best novel. Only one year. And I think at least one year a book. And I think there were two years where actually my final choice won because the books didn't work from. But yes, not every time, but in general, the past few years of Hugo winners have been good, have been very good. And so and this one, I'm like I said, it wasn't my first choice, but I'm perfectly happy with it winning.
Yeah, cool. Well, so before we sign off, Cora, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on corabuhlert.com, that's corabuhlert.com, or sometimes about once a month at galacticjourney.org. Next month I talk about a brilliant young filmmaker who just wins an award at the Oberhausen Short Film Festival named George Lucas for THX, and I forgot the number, but it's this old short film version. So we introduce him, and I also talk about student protests turning violent in Germany, because it's 1968 now. It's that year where the student protests gradually turn more and more violent. Actually, they started in 1962, turned violent in 1967. And it's really fascinating to see all that happening in real time. And yes, you can find me on Twitter at Cora Bullard, again, CoraBullert. And if you want to read my fiction, you can find it on all the various online bookstores, stores for the standalone stuff, or you can find it in all sorts of various magazines, anthologies, and so on.
Next, Cora, was it you who wrote the cold crowdfunding campaign?
Yeah, that was me. That was me.
Oh, that's excellent.
Thank you.
I neglected, when we did an episode on the cold equations on Take Me to Reader, I neglected to mention it, and I felt terrible. Yeah,
that was me. That was a model of a spur of the moment thing, because someone talked about crowdfunding. Someone mentioned in a completely different context, it's like code equations, but with crowdfunding. I said, okay, why not write the actual code equations with crowdfunding?
Yes. Yes. I'll drop a link into the show notes for that.
Yeah, and guest star parts from several prominent science fiction authors and other personalities. Yeah. Including John W. Campbell.
Oh, cool.
Yes, he is very insistent on throwing the girl out of the airlock. Because Campbell,
yes, that sounds about right. Throw her out of the
airlock. Do you actually know that the Muppet Show did the Cold Equations as a Pigs in Space episode?
And we didn't cover that on Take Me to Your Reader.
Yeah, it's obvious. Inspiration is really obvious if you know what it is. It's also the same. Oh, we need to throw someone overboard, and the two male pigs, Link and I forgot what the doctor pig is called. They conspire to throw Miss Piggy overboard, but you don't throw Miss Piggy overboard. So yeah, guess who goes overboard? It's Miss Piggy vindicating Merlin. Well, long before pretty much everybody else did.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Cor, this was an absolute delight. It's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right. Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Cora. I thought she was great. She's always fun to talk to. So make sure to check out her links in the show notes. I'll definitely put a link there to the Cold crowdfunding campaign, which is a fantastic story. It's a great answer to the Cold Equations if you've ever read that story. But as I mentioned at the top, I don't want to bear the lead here. I did want to make an appeal to you, my listener, to help me with some feedback for what you'd like to see on this podcast going forward, because I'm only just a couple titles from finishing the main project that I started here. And so I'm putting together a Google form that you can fill out and kind of tell me what kind of content you've enjoyed here, anything that you would like to see more of, anything you'd like to see less of as well. And so I'm putting that together now. In a future podcast, I will announce that it's ready and put a link in the show notes as well. But I'll also send it out on social media. If you are not on Twitter, for instance, and you want to be a recipient of that form, do shoot me an email, feedback@uwaspodcast.com, and I'll make sure that you're on the list for when I send that out, because I want to gather as much data as I can as I'm figuring out what I want to do with the podcast after I finish the main project that I started. That being said, I also want to remind you, as I mentioned several times on the podcast with Cora, I have another podcast, Take Me to Your Reader, where we talk about science fiction movies adapted from books. It's a really fun podcast. We've been doing it for 9 years, I believe, and we have over 100 episodes out there. I think it's fun stuff. We'll keep doing it for the foreseeable future, so make sure to check that out. I'll put a couple notes in the show notes for episodes that I mentioned in this podcast. Of course, Hugo's There is available as a potential nomination for the Best Fancast Hugo Award this year, so if you want to nominate, that'd be fantastic. I'd appreciate it. I've got a list of podcasts that I'm going to nominate as well. In the meantime, if you want to support the podcast, all my podcasting, you can go to patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast and sign up there. And also, you can just share on social media and tell other people about this podcast. That'd be great. And if you want to reach out to me in any way to say, you know, thanks for the podcast or anything like that, you can do that on Twitter @Hugo's Podcast. You can go to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form there, or you can send me an email directly, feedback@hugospodcast.com, as I mentioned earlier. So I'd love to hear from you. And I think that'll about do it for this episode. So thank you again so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.